Welcome to this Uvula audio presentation of A Tramp Abroad by Mark Twain. Volume 12, Chapter 32, The Jungfrau, the Bride, and the Piano. We located ourselves at the Jungfrau Hotel, one of those huge establishments which the knees of modern travel have created in every attractive spot on the continent. There was a great gathering at dinner, and as usual, one heard all sorts of languages. The table d'hôte was served by waitresses dressed in the quaint and comely costume of the Swiss peasants. This consists of a simple gros de lawn, trimmed with ashes of roses, with overskirt of scarbleu ventre sans gris, cut bias on the offside, with facings of petite polonaise, and narrow insertions of pâté de foie gras, backstitched to the mise-en-scène in the form of a jus d'esprit. It gives to the wearer a singularly piquant and alluring aspect. One of these waitresses, a woman of 40, had side whiskers reaching halfway down her jaws. They were 2 fingers broad, dark in color and pretty thick, and the hairs were 1 inch long. One sees many women on the continent with quite conspicuous mustaches, but this was the only woman I had ever seen who had reached the dignity of whiskers. After dinner, the guests of both sexes distributed themselves around the front porches and the ornamental grounds belonging to the hotel to enjoy the cool air. But as the twilight deepened toward darkness, they gathered themselves together in that saddest and solemnest and most constrained of all places, the great blank drawing room, which is the chief feature of all continental summer hotels. There they grouped themselves about in couples and threes, and mumbled in bated voices, and looked timid and homeless and forlorn. There was a small piano in this room, a clattery, wheezy, asthmatic thing, certainly the very worst miscarriage in the way of a piano that the world has ever seen. In turn, 5 or 6 dejected and homesick ladies approached it doubtingly, gave it a single inquiring thump, and retired with the lockjaw. But the boss of that instrument was to come, nonetheless, and from my own country, from Arkansas. She was a brand new bride, innocent, girlish, happy in herself, and her grave and worshipping stripling of a husband. She was about 18, just out of school, unconscious of that passionless multitude around her, and the very first time she smote that old wreck, one recognized it had met its destiny. Her stripling brought an armful of aged sheet music from their room, for this bride went heeled, as you might say, and bent himself lovingly over and got ready to turn pages. The bride fetched a swoop with her fingers from one end of the keyboard to the other, just to get her bearings, as it were, and you could see the congregation set their teeth with the agony of it. Then, without any more preliminaries, she turned on all the horrors of the Battle of Prague, that venerable chivalry, and waded chin deep into the blood of the slain. She made a fair and honorable average of 2 false notes in 5, but her soul was in arms, and she never stopped to correct. The audience stood it with pretty fair grit for a while, but when the cannonade waxed hotter and fiercer and the discord average rose to 4 in 5, the procession began to move. A few stragglers held their ground 10 minutes longer, but when the girl began to wring the true inwardness out of the cries of the wounded, they struck their colors and retired in a kind of panic. There never was a completer victory. I was the only non-combatant left on the field. I would not have deserted my countrywomen anyhow, but indeed I had no desires in that direction. None of us liked mediocrity, but we all reverenced perfection. This girl's music was perfection in its way. It was the worst music that has ever been achieved on our planet by a mere human being. I moved up close and never lost a strain. When she got through, I asked her to play it again. She did it with a pleased alacrity and a heightened enthusiasm. She made it all discords this time. She got an amount of anguish into the cries of the wounded that shed a new light on human suffering. She was on the war path all evening, All the time, crowds of people gathered on the porches and pressed their noses against the windows to look and marvel, but the bravest never ventured in. The bride went off satisfied and happy with her young fellow, while her appetite was finally gorged, and the tourists swarmed back in again. What a change has come over Switzerland, and in fact all of Europe during this century. 70 or 80 years ago, Napoleon was the only man in Europe who could really be called a traveler. He was the only man who had devoted his attention to it and taken a powerful interest in it. He was the only man who had traveled extensively. But now everybody goes everywhere. But I digress. In the morning, when we looked out of our windows, we saw a wonderful sight. Across the valley, and apparently quite neighborly and close at hand, the giant form of the Jungfrau rose cold and white into the clear sky beyond a gateway in the near highlands. It reminded me somehow of one of those colossal billows which swells suddenly up beside one's ship at sea, sometimes with its crest and shoulders snowy white, and the rest of its noble proportions streaked downward with creamy foam. I took out my sketchbook and made a little picture of the Jungfrau, merely to get its shape. I do not regard this as one of my finished works. In fact, I do not rank it among my works at all. It is only a study. It is hardly more than what one might call a sketch. Other artists have done me the grace to admire it, but I am severe in my judgments on my own pictures, and this one does not move me. It was hard to believe that the lofty wooded rampart on our left, which so overtops the Jungfrau, was not actually the higher of the two, but it was not. It is only 2,000 or 3,000 feet high, and of course has no snow upon it in the summer, whereas the Jungfrau is not much shorter than 14,000 feet high, and therefore that lowest verge of snow on her side, which seems nearly down to the valley level, is really about 7,000 feet higher up in the air than the summit of that wooded rampart. It is the distance that makes the deception. The wooded height is but 4 or 5 miles removed from us, but the Jungfrau is 4 or 5 times that distance away. Walking down the street of shops in the forenoon, I was attracted by a large picture, carved frame and all from a single block of chocolate-colored wood. There are some people who know everything. Some of these had told us that continental shopkeepers always raise their prices on English and Americans. Many people had told us it was expensive to buy things through a courier, whereas I had supposed it was just the reverse. When I saw this picture, I conjectured it was worth more than the friend I proposed to buy it for would like to pay. But still, it was worthwhile to inquire. So I told the courier to step in and ask the price as if he wanted it for himself. I told him not to speak in English, and above all, not to reveal the fact that he was a courier. Then I moved on a few yards and waited. The courier came presently and reported the price. I said to myself, "Is 100 francs too much?" And so dismissed the matter from my mind. But in the afternoon I was passing that place with Harris, and the picture attracted me again. We stepped in to see how much higher broken German would raise the price. The shopwoman named a figure just 100 francs lower than the courier had named. This was a pleasant surprise. I said I would take it. After I had given directions as to where it was to be shipped, the shopwoman said appealingly,
"If you please, do not let your courier know you bought it."
This was an unexpected remark, and I said, "What makes you think I have a courier?"
"Ah, that is very simple. He told me himself."
"He was very thoughtful, but tell me, why did you charge him more than you are charging me?"
"That is very simple also. I do not have to pay you a percentage."
"Oh, I begin to see. You would have had to have paid the courier a percentage."
"Undoubtedly. The courier always has his percentage. In this case, it would have been 100 francs.
"Then the tradesman does not pay a part of it? The purchaser pays all of it?"
"Well, there are occasions when the tradesman and the courier agree upon the price, which is twice or thrice the value of the article. Then the two divide, and both get a percentage."
"I see. But it seems to me that the purchaser does all the buying even then."
"Oh, to be sure, it goes without saying."
"But I have bought this picture myself. Therefore, why shouldn't the courier know it?" The woman exclaimed in distress,
"Ach, Indeed, it would take all my little profit. He would come and demand his 100 francs, and I should have to pay.
But he has not done the buying. You could refuse.
I dare not refuse. He would never bring travellers here again. More than that, he would denounce me to the other couriers, and they would divert custom from me, and my business would be injured.
I went away in a thoughtful frame of mind. I began to see why a courier could afford to work for $55 a month and fares. A month or two later, I was able to understand why a courier did not have to pay any board and lodging, and why my hotel bills were always larger when I had him with me than when I left him behind for a few days. Another thing was also explained now, apparently. In one town, I had taken the courier to the bank to do the translating when I drew some money. I sat in the reading room till the transaction was finished. Then a clerk had brought the money to me in person, and had been exceedingly polite, even going so far as to precede me to the door and holding it open for me, and bow me out as if I had been a distinguished personage. It was a new experience. Exchange had been in my favor ever since I had been in Europe, but just that one time, I got simply the face of my draft and no extra francs, whereas I had expected to get quite a number of them. This was the first time I had ever used the courier at the bank. I had suspected something then, and as long as he remained with me afterwards, I managed bank matters by myself. Still, if I felt I could afford the tax, I would never travel without a courier, for a good courier is a convenience whose value cannot be estimated in dollars and cents. Without him, travel is a bitter harassment, a purgatory of little exasperating annoyances, a ceaseless and pitiless punishment. I mean to an irascible man who has no business capacity and is confused by details. Without a courier, travel hasn't a ray of pleasure in it anywhere, but with him it is a continuous and unruffled delight. He's always at hand, never has to be sent for. If your bell is not answered promptly, and it seldom is, you have only to open the door and speak. The courier will hear, and he will have the order attended to, or raise an insurrection. You will tell him what day you will start, where you are going, leave all the rest to him. You need not inquire about trains or fares or car changes or hotels or anything else. At the proper time, he will put you in a cab or an omnibus and drive you to the train or the boat. He has packed your luggage and transferred it. He has paid all the bills. Other people have preceded you half an hour to scramble for impossible places and lose their tempers, but you can take your time. The courier has secured your seats for you, and you can occupy them at your leisure. At the station, the crowds mash one another to a pulp in an effort to get the weigher's attention for their trunks. They dispute hotly with these tyrants, who are cool and indifferent. They get their baggage billets at last, then have another squeeze and another rage over the disheartening business of trying to get them recorded and paid for. And still another over the equally disheartening business of trying to get near enough to the ticket office to buy a ticket. And now, with their tempers gone to the dogs, they must stand penned up and packed together, laden with wraps and satchels and shawl straps, with the weary wife and babies in the waiting room, till the doors are thrown open. Then all hands make a grand final rush to the train, find it full and have to stand on the platform and fret until some more cars are put on. They are in a condition to kill somebody by this time. Meantime, you have been sitting in your car, smoking, and observing all this misery in the extremest comfort. On the journey, the guard is polite and watchful, and won't allow anybody to get into your compartment. Tells them you are just recovering from smallpox and do not like to be disturbed. For the courier has made everything right with the guard. At the way stations, the courier comes to your compartment to see if you want a glass of water, or a newspaper, or anything. At eating stations, he sends luncheon out to you, while the other people scramble and worry in the dining cars. If anything breaks about the car you are in, and a station master proposes to pack you and your agent into a compartment with strangers, the courier reveals to him confidentially that you are a French duke born deaf and dumb, and the official comes and makes affable signs that he has ordered a choice car to be added to the train for you. At custom houses, the multitude file tediously through, hot and irritated, and look on while the officers burrow into the trunks and make a mess of everything. but you hand your keys to the courier and sit still. Perhaps you arrive at your destination in a rainstorm at 10 at night. You generally do. The multitude spend half an hour verifying their baggage and getting it transferred to the omnibuses. But the courier puts you into a vehicle without a moment's loss of time. And when you reach your hotel, you find your rooms have been secured 2 or 3 days in advance. Everything is ready. You can go to bed at once. Some of those other people have to drift around 2 or 3 hotels in the rain before they finally find accommodations. I have not set down half of the virtues that are vested in a good courier, but I think I have set down a sufficiency of them to show that an irritable man who can afford one and does not employ him is not a wise economist. My courier was the worst in Europe, yet he was a good deal better than none at all. It could not pay him to be a better one than he was, because I could not afford to buy things through him. He was a good enough courier for the small amount he got out of his service. Yes, to travel with a courier is bliss. To travel without one is the reverse. I have had dealings with some very bad couriers, but I have also had dealings with one who might fairly be called perfection. He was a young Polander named Joseph N. Vere. He spoke 8 languages and seemed to be equally at home in all of them. He was shrewd, prompt, posted, and punctual. He was fertile in resources and singularly gifted in the matter of overcoming difficulties. He not only knew how to do everything in his line, but he knew the best ways and the quickest. He was handy with children and invalids. All his employer needed to do was to take life easy and leave everything to the courier. His address is care of Messrs. Gay and Son, Strand, London. He was formerly a conductor of Gay's tourist parties. Excellent couriers are somewhat rare. If the reader is about to travel, he will find it to his advantage to make note of this one. Chapter 33 We Climb Far by Buggy. The beautiful Giesbach Fall is near Interlaken, on the other side of the Lake of Briens, and is illuminated every night with those gorgeous theatrical fires whose name I cannot recall just at this moment. This was said to be a spectacle which the tourist ought to by no means miss. I was strongly tempted, but I could not go there with propriety, because one goes in a boat. The task which I had set myself to was to walk over Europe on foot, not skim over it in a boat. I had made a tacit contract with myself. It was my duty to abide by it. I was willing to make boat trips for pleasure, but I could not conscientiously make them in the way of business. It cost me something of a pang to lose that fine sight, but I lived down the desire and gained in my self-respect through the triumph. I had a finer and a grander sight, however, where I was. This was the mighty dome of the Jungfrau, softly outlined against the sky and faintly silvered by the moonlight. There was something subduing in the influence of that silent and solemn and awful presence. One seemed to meet the immutable, the indestructible, the eternal, face to face, and to feel the trivial and fleeting nature of his own existence the more sharply by the contrast. One had the sense of being under the brooding contemplation of a spirit, not an inert mass of rocks and ice. The spirit which had looked down through the slow drift of the ages upon a million vanished races of men and judged them, and would judge a million more and still be there, watching unchanged and unchangeable, after all life should be gone and earth had become a vacant desolation. While I was feeling these things, I was groping, without knowing it, toward an understanding of what the spell is which people find in the Alps, and in no other mountains, that strange, deep, nameless influence which, once felt, cannot be forgotten. Once felt, leaves always behind it a restless longing to feel it again, a longing which is like homesickness, a grieving, haunting yearning which will plead, implore, and persecute till it has its will. I met dozens of people, imaginative and unimaginative, cultivated and uncultivated, who had come from far countries and roamed through the Swiss Alps year after year. They could not explain why. They had first come, they said, out of an idle curiosity, because everybody talked about it. They had come since because they could not help it. And they should keep on coming while they lived for the same reason. They had tried to break their chains and stay away, but it was futile. Now they had no desire to break them. Others came nearer, formulating what they felt. They said they could find perfect rest and peace nowhere else when they were troubled. All frets and worries and chafings sank to sleep in the presence of the benignant serenity of the Alps. The great spirits of the mountain breathed his own peace upon their hurt minds and sore hearts and healed them. They could not think base thoughts or do mean and sordid things here before the visible throne of God. Down the road a piece was Kursaal, whatever that may be, and we joined the human tide to see what sort of enjoyment it might afford. It was the usual open-air concert in an ornamental garden with wine, beer, milk, whey, grapes, etc., the whey and the grapes being necessities of life to certain invalids whom physicians cannot repair, and who only continue to exist by the grace of whey and grapes. One of these departed spirits told me in a sad and lifeless way that there is no way for him to live but by whey, and he dearly, dearly loved whey, though he didn't know whey he did, but he did. After making this pun, he died. That is the way it served him. Some other remains, preserved from decomposition by the grape system, told me that the grapes were of a peculiar breed, highly medicinal in their nature, and that they were counted out and administered by the grape doctors as methodically as if they were pills. The new patient, if very feeble, began with one grape before breakfast, took three during breakfast, a couple during meals, five at luncheon, three in the afternoon, seven at dinner, four for supper, and part of a grape just before going to bed, by way of a general regulator. The quantity was gradually and regularly increased, according to the needs and capacities of the patient, until by and by you would find him disposing of his one grape per second all the day long and his regular barrel every day. He said that the men cured in this way and enabled to discard the grape system never afterwards got over the habit of talking as if they were dictating to a slow amanuensis, because they always made a pause between each two words while they sucked the substance out of an imaginary grape. He said that these were tedious people to talk with. He said that men who had been cured by the other process were easily distinguished from the rest of mankind because they always tilted their heads back between every two words and swallowed a swig of imaginary whey. He said it was an impressive thing to observe two men who had been cured by the two processes engaged in conversation. Said their pauses and accompanying movements were so continuous and regular that a stranger would think himself in the presence of a couple of automatic machines. One finds out a great many wonderful things by traveling, if he stumbles upon the right person. I did not remain long at Kursaal. The music was good enough, but it seemed rather tame after the cyclone of that Arkansas expert. Besides, my adventurous spirit had conceived a formidable enterprise, nothing less than a trip from Interlaken by the Gemmi and Visp, clear to Zermatt, on foot. So it was necessary to plan the details and get ready for an early start. The courier, this was not the one I have just been speaking of, thought that the porter of the hotel would be able to tell us how to find our way. And so it turned out. He showed us the whole thing on a relief map, and we could see our route, with all its elevations and depressions, its villages and its rivers, as clearly as if we were sailing over it in a balloon. A relief map is a great thing. The porter also wrote down each day's journey and the nightly hotel on a piece of paper, and made our course so plain that we should never be able to get lost without high-priced outside help. I put the courier in the care of a gentleman who was going to Lucon, and then went to bed, after laying out the walking costumes and putting them in condition for instant occupation in the morning. However, when we came down to breakfast at 8 a.m., it looked so much like rain, I hired a 2-horse top buggy for the first third of the journey. For 2 or 3 hours, we jogged along the level road, which skirts the beautiful Lake of Thun, and a dim and dreamlike picture of watery expanses and spectral alpine forms were always before us, veiled in a mellowing mist. Then a steady downpour set in and hit everything but the nearest objects. We kept the rain out of our faces with umbrellas and away from our bodies with the leather apron of the buggy, but the driver sat unsheltered and placidly soaked the weather in and seemed to like it. We had the road to ourselves, and I never had a pleasanter excursion. The weather began to clear while we were driving up a valley called Kienthal, and presently a vast black cloud bank in front of us dissolved away and uncurtained the grand proportions and the soaring loftiness of the Blumus Alp. It was a sort of breathtaking surprise, for we had not supposed there was anything behind that low-hung blanket of sable cloud but a level valley. What we had been mistaking for fleeting glimpses of sky aloft were really patches of the Blumus's snowy crest caught through shredded rents in the drifting pall of vapor. We dined in the inn at Frutigen, and our driver ought to have dined there too, but he would not have had time to dine and get drunk both, so he gave his mind to making a masterpiece of the latter, and succeeded. A German gentleman and his 2 young lady daughters had been taking their nooning at the inn, and when they left just ahead of us, it was plain that their driver was just as drunk as ours, and as happy and good-natured too, which was saying a good deal. These rascals overflowed with attentions and information for their guests, and with brotherly love for each other. They tied their reins and took off their coats and hats, so they might be able to give unencumbered attention to conversation and to the gestures necessary for its illustration. The road was smooth. It led up and down a continual succession of hills, but it was narrow. The horses were used to it, and could not get well out of it anyway. So why shouldn't the drivers entertain themselves and us? The noses of our horses projected sociably into the rear of the forward carriage, and as we toiled up the long hills, our driver stood up and talked to his friend, and his friend stood up and talked back to him, with his rear to the scenery. When the top was reached, we went flying down the other side. There was no change in the program. I carry in my memory yet the picture of that forward driver on his knees on his high seat, resting his elbows on his back, and beaming down on his passengers with happy eyes and flying hair and a jolly red face, and offering his card to the old German gentleman while he praised his hack and horses, and both teams were whizzing down a long hill with nobody in a position to tell whether we were bound to destruction or an undeserved safety. Toward sunset, we entered a beautiful green valley dotted with chalets, a cozy little domain hidden away from the busy world in a cloistered nook among giant precipices, topped with snowy peaks that seemed to float like islands above the curling surf of the sea of vapor that severed them from the lower world. Down from vague and vaporous heights, little ruffled zigzag milky currents came crawling, and found their way to the verge of one of those tremendous overhanging walls where they plunged a shaft of silver, shivered to atoms in mid-descent, and turned to an air puff of luminous dust. Here and there, in grooved depressions among the snowy desolations of the upper altitudes, one glimpsed the extremity of a glacier with its sea-green and honeycomb battlements of ice. Up the valley, under a dizzy precipice, nestled the village of Kandersteg, our halting place for the night. We were soon there and housed in the hotel, but the waning day had such an inviting influence that we did not remain housed many moments, but struck out and followed a roaring torrent of ice water up to its far source in a sort of little grass-carpeted parlor, walled in all around by vast precipices and overlooked by clustering summits of ice. This was the snuggest little croquet ground imaginable. It was perfectly level, and not more than 1 mile long by 1/2 mile wide. The walls around it were so gigantic, and everything about it was on so mighty a scale, that it was belittled by contrast to what I have likened it to, a cozy and carpeted parlor. It was so high above the Kondersteg Valley that there was nothing between it and the snowy peaks. I had never been in such intimate relations with the high altitudes before. The snow peaks had always been remote and unapproachable grandeurs hitherto, but now we were hobnob, if one may use such a seemingly irreverent expression, about creations so august as these. We could see the streams which fed the torrent we had followed issuing from under the greenish ramparts of glaciers, but two or three of these, instead of flowing over the precipices, sank down into the rock and sprang in big jets out of holes in the mid-face of the walls. The green nook which I have been describing is called Gasternthal. The glacier streams gather and flow through it in a broad and rushing brook to a narrow cleft between lofty precipices. Here the rushing brook becomes a mad torrent and goes booming and thundering down towards Kondersteg, lashing and thrashing its way over and among monster boulders and hurling chance roots and logs about like straws. There was no lack of cascades along this route. The path by the side of the torrent was so narrow that one had to look sharp when he heard a cowbell and hunt for a place that was wide enough to accommodate a cow and a Christian side by side. Such places were not always to be had at an instant's notice. The cows wore church bells, and that is a good idea of the cows, for where the torrent is, you couldn't hear an ordinary cowbell any further than you could hear the ticking of a watch. I needed exercise, so I employed my agent in setting stranded logs and dead trees adrift, and I sat on a boulder and watched them go whirling and leaping head over heels down the boiling torrent. It was a wonderfully exhilarating spectacle. When I had had enough exercise, I made the agent take some by running a race with one of those logs. I made a trifle by betting on the log. After dinner, we had a walk up and down the Kondersteg Valley in the soft gloaming, with the spectacle of the dying lights of day playing about the crests and pinnacles of the still and solemn upper realm for contrast, and text for talk. There were no sounds but the dulled complaining of the torrent and the occasional tinkling of a distant bell. The spirit of the place was a sense of deep, pervading peace. One might dream his life tranquilly away there, and not miss it or mind it when it was gone. The summer departed with the sun, and winter came with the stars. It grew to be a bitter night in that little hotel, backed up against a precipice that had no visible top to it. But we kept warm and woke in time in the morning to find that everybody else had left for the Gemmi 3 hours before. So our little plan of helping that German family, principally the old man over the pass, was a blocked generosity. Chapter 34. The World's Highest Pig Farm. We hired the only guide left to lead us on our way. He was over 70, but he could have given me 9/10 of his strength and still had all his age entitled to him. He shouldered our satchels, overcoats, and alpenstocks, and we set out up the steep path. It was hot work. The old man soon begged us to hand over our coats and waistcoats to him to carry too, and we did. One could not refuse so little a thing to a poor old man like that. He should have had them if he had been 150. When we began that descent, we could see a microscopic chalet perched away up against heaven on what seemed to be the highest mountain near us. It was on our right, across the narrow head of the valley. But when we got up abreast it on its own level, the mountains were towering high above our hand, and we saw that its altitude was just about that of the little Gasternthal which we had visited the evening before. Still, it seemed a long way up in the air. In that waste and lonely wilderness of rocks, it had been an unfenced grass plot in front of us, which seemed to be about as big as a billiard table, and this grass plot slanted so sharply downward and was so brief and ended so exceedingly soon at the verge of the absolute precipice that it was a shuddery thing to think of a person's venturing to trust his foot on an incline so situated at all. Suppose a man stepped on an orange peel in that yard. There'd be nothing for him to seize, nothing that could keep him from rolling. 5 revolutions would bring him to the edge, and over he'd go. What a frightful distance he would fall, for there are very few birds that fly as high as his starting point. He would strike and bounce 2 or 3 times on his way down, but this would be no advantage to him. I would as soon take an airing on the slant of a rainbow as in such a front yard. I would rather, in fact, for the distance down would be about the same, and it is pleasanter to slide down than to bounce. I could not see how the peasants got up to that chalet. The region seemed too steep for anything but a balloon. As we strolled on, climbing up higher and higher, we were continually bringing neighboring peaks into view and lofty prominence which had been hidden behind lower peaks before. So by and by, while standing before a group of these giants, we looked around for the chalet again. And there it was, way down below us, apparently on an inconspicuous ridge in the valley. It was as far below us now as it had been above us when we were beginning the ascent. After a while, the path led us along a railed precipice, and we looked over. Far beneath us was the snug parlor again, the little Gasternthal, with its water jets spouting from the face of its rock walls. We could have dropped a stone into it. We had been finding the top of the world all along, and always finding a still higher top stealing into view in a disappointing way just ahead. When we looked down into the Gasternthal, we felt pretty sure that we had reached the genuine top at last. But that was not so. There were much higher altitudes to be scaled yet. We were still in the pleasant shade of forest trees. We were still in a region which was cushioned with beautiful mosses and aglow with the many-tinted luster of innumerable wildflowers. We found, indeed, more interest in the wildflowers than in anything else. We gathered a specimen or two of every kind which we were unacquainted with, so we had sumptuous bouquets. But one of the chief interests lay in chasing the seasons of the year up the mountain, and determining them by the presence of flowers and berries which we were acquainted with. For instance, it was the end of August at the level of the sea. In Kandersteg Valley, at the base of the pass, we found flowers which would not be due at sea level for 2 or 3 weeks. Higher up, we entered October and gathered fringed gentians. I made no notes and have forgotten the details, but the construction of the floral calendar was very entertaining while it lasted. In the high regions, we found a rich store of the splendid red flower called the Alpine Rose, but we did not find any examples of the ugly Swiss favorite called Edelweiss. Its name seemed to indicate that it is a noble flower and that it is white. It may be noble enough, but it is not attractive, and it is not white. The fuzzy blossom is the color of bad cigar ashes, and appears to be made of a cheap quality of gray plush. It has a noble and distant way of confining itself to the high altitudes, but that is probably on account of its looks. It apparently has no monopoly of those upper altitudes, however, for they are sometimes intruded upon by some of the loveliest of the valley families of wildflowers. Everybody in the Alps wears a sprig of Edelweiss in his hat. It is the native's pet, and also the tourist's. All morning we loafed along, having a good time. Other pedestrians went staving by us with vigorous strides, and with the intent and determined look of men who were walking for a wager. These wore loose knee breeches, long yarn stockings, and hobnail high-lace walking shoes. They were gentlemen who would go home to England or Germany and tell how many miles they had beaten the guidebook by every day, but I doubted if they ever had much real fun outside of the mere magnificent exhilaration of the tramp through the green valleys and the breezy heights, for they were almost always alone, and even the finest scenery loses incalculably when there is no one to enjoy it with. All the morning an endless double procession of mule-mounted tourists filed past us along the narrow path, the one procession going and the other coming. We had taken a good deal of trouble to teach ourselves the kindly German custom of saluting all strangers with a doffed hat, and we resolutely clung to it. although it kept us bareheaded most of the time and was not always responded to. Still, we found an interest in the thing because we naturally liked to know who were English and Americans among the passers-by. All continental natives responded, of course. So did some of the English and Americans. But as a general rule, these two races gave no sign. Whenever a man or woman showed us cold neglect, we spoke up confidently in our own tongue and asked for such information as we happened to need, and we always got a reply in the same language. The English and American folk are not less kindly than the other races. They are only more reserved, and that comes of habit and education. In one dreary, rocky waste, away above the line of vegetation, we met a procession of 25 mounted young men, all from America. We got answering bows enough from these, of course, for they were of an age to learn to do in Rome as Rome does, without much effort. At one extremity of this patch of desolation, overhung by bare and forbidding crags, which husbanded drifts of everlasting snow in their shaded cavities, was a small stretch of thin and discouraged grass, and a man and a family of pigs were actually living there in some shanties. Consequently, this place could be reckoned as a property. It had a money value and was doubtless taxed. I think it must have marked the limit of real estate in this world. It would be hard to set a money value upon any piece of earth that lies between that spot and the empty realm of space. That man may claim the distinction of owning the end of the world, for if there is any definite end to the world, he has certainly found it. From here forward, we move through a storm-swept and smileless desolation. All about us rose gigantic masses, crags, and ramparts of barren, dreary rock, with not a vestige or semblance of plant or tree or flower anywhere, or glimpse of any creature that had life. The frost and the tempests of unnumbered ages had battered and hacked at these cliffs with a deathless energy, destroying them piecemeal. So all the region about their bases was a tumbled chaos of great fragments which had been split off and hurled to the ground. Soiled and aged banks of snow lay close about our path. The ghastly desolation of the place was as tremendously complete as if Doré had furnished the working plans for it. But every now and then, through the stern gateways around us, we caught a view of some neighboring majestic dome, sheathed with glittering ice and displaying its white purity at an elevation compared to which ours was groveling and plebeian. And this spectacle always chained one's interest and admiration at once, and made him forget there was anything ugly in the world. I've just said that there was nothing but death and desolation in these hideous places, but I forgot. In the most forlorn and arid and dismal one of all, where the racked and splintered debris was the thickest, where ancient patches of snow lay against the very path, where the winds blew bitterest and the general aspect was mournfulest and dreariest, and furthest from any suggestion of cheer or of hope, I found a solitary wee forget-me-not flourishing away, not a droop about it anywhere, but holding its bright blue star up with the prettiest and gallantest air in the world, the only happy spirit, the only smiling thing in all that grisly desert. She seemed to say, "Cheer up! As long as we are here, let us make the best of it." I judged she had earned a right to a more hospitable place, so I plucked her and sent her to America, to a friend who would respect her for the fight she had made, all by her small self, to make a whole vast despondent alpine desolation stop breaking its heart over the unalterable, and hold up its head and look at the bright side of things for once. We stopped for a nooning at a strong-built little inn called the Schwarenbach. It sits in a lonely spot among the peaks, where it is swept by the trailing fringes of the cloud rack, and is rained on and snowed on and pelted and persecuted by the storms nearly every day of its life. It was the only habitation in the whole of the Gemmi Pass. Close at hand now was a chance for a blood-curdling alpine adventure. Close at hand was the snowy mass of the great Altals, cooling its top knot in the sky and daring us an ascent. I was fired up with the idea, and immediately made up my mind to procure the necessary guides, ropes, etc., and undertake it. I instructed Harris to go to the landlord of the inn and set him about our preparations. Meanwhile, I went diligently to work to read up and find out what this much-talked-of mountain climbing was like, and how one should go about it, for in these matters I was ignorant. I opened Mr. Hinchcliffe's Summer Months Among the Alps, published 1857, and selected his account of his ascent of Mount Rosa. It began, quote, "It is very difficult to free the mind from excitement on the evening before a grand expedition." Unquote. Well, I saw I was too calm, so I walked the room a while and worked myself into high excitement. But the book's next remark, that the adventurer must get up at 2 a.m, came as near as anything to flatting it all out again. However, I reinforced it and read on about how Mr. Hinchcliffe dressed by candlelight and was soon down among the guides who were bustling about in the passage, packing provisions and making every preparation for the start, and how he glanced out into the cold, clear night and saw that, quote, "The whole sky was blazing with stars, larger and brighter than they appear through the dense atmosphere breathed by inhabitants of the lower parts of the earth. They seemed actually suspended from the dark vault of heaven, and their gentle light shed a fairy-like gleam over the snow fields around the foot of the Matterhorn, which raised its stupendous pinnacle on high, penetrating to the heart of the Great Bear, and crowning itself with a diadem of his magnificent stars. Not a sound disturbed the deep tranquillity of the night, except the distant roar of streams, which rush from the high plateau of the St. Theodule Glacier, and fall headlong over the precipitous rocks, till they lose themselves in the mazes of the Gorner Glacier." Unquote. He took his hot toast and coffee, and then about 3:30, his caravan of 10 men filed away from the Riffle Hotel and began the steep climb. At 5:30, he happened to turn around and quote, "beheld the glorious spectacle of the Matterhorn, just touched by the rosy-fingered morning, and looking like a huge pyramid of fire, rising out of the barren ocean of ice and rock around it." Unquote. Then the Brighthorn and the Dent Blanche caught the radiant glow, but, quote, "the intervening mass of Monte Rosa made it necessary for us to climb away many long hours before we could hope to see the sun himself, yet the whole air soon grew warmer after the splendid birth of the day." Unquote. He gazed at the lofty crown of Monte Rosa and the wastes of snow that guarded its steep approaches, and the chief guide delivered the opinion that no man could conquer that awful height and put his foot upon the summit. But the adventurers moved on steadily, nevertheless. They toiled up and up, and still up. They passed the grand plateau, then toiled up a steep shoulder of the mountain, clinging like flies to its rugged face, and now they were confronted by a tremendous wall from which great blocks of ice and snow were evidently in the habit of falling. They turned aside to skirt the wall and gradually ascended until their way was barred by a maze of gigantic snow crevices. So they turned aside again and, quote, "began a long climb of sufficient steepness to make a zigzag course necessary." Unquote. Fatigue compelled them to halt frequently for a moment or two. At one of these halts, somebody called out, "Look at Mount Blanc," and, quote, "we were made at once aware of the very great height we had attained by actually seeing the monarch of the Alps and his attendant satellites right over the top of the Brighthorn, itself at least 14,000 feet high." Unquote. These people moved in a single line and were all tied to a strong rope at regular distances apart, so that if one of them slipped on those giddy heights, the others would brace themselves on their alpenstocks and save him from darting into the valley, thousands of feet below. By and by, they came to an ice-coated ridge, which was tilted up at a steep angle, and had a precipice on one side of it. They had to climb this, so the guide in the lead cut steps in the ice with his hatchet, and as fast as he took his toes out of one of these slight holes, the toes of the man behind him occupied it. Quote, "Slowly and steadily we kept our way over this dangerous part of the ascent, and I dare say it was fortunate for some of us that attention was distracted from the head by the paramount necessity of looking after the feet. For while on the left the incline of ice was so steep that it could be impossible for any man to save himself in case of a slip, unless the others could hold him up, on the right we might drop a pebble from the hand over precipices of unknown extent down upon the tremendous glacier below. Great caution, therefore, was absolutely necessary, and in this exposed situation we were attacked by all the fury of that grand enemy of aspirants to Mount Rosa, a severe and bitterly cold wind from the north. The fine powdery snow was driven past us in clouds, penetrating the interstices of our clothes, and the pieces of ice which flew from the blows of Peter's axe were whisked away into the air, and then dashed over the precipice. We had quite enough to do to prevent ourselves from being served in the same ruthless fashion, and now and then, in the more violent gusts of wind, we were glad to stick our alpenstocks into the snow and hold on hard." Unquote. Having surmounted this perilous steep, they sat down and took a brief rest with their backs against a sheltering rock and their heels dangling over a bottomless abyss. Then they climbed to the base of another ridge, a more difficult and dangerous one still. Quote, "The whole of the ridge was exceedingly narrow, and the fall on each side desperately steep. But the ice in some of these intervals between the masses of rock assumed the form of a mere sharp edge, almost like a knife. These places, though not more than 3 or 4 short paces in length, looked uncommonly awkward. But, like the sword leading true believers to the gates of paradise, they must needs be passed before we could attain the summit of our ambition. These were in 1 or 2 places so narrow that in stepping over them with toes well turned out for greater security, one end of the foot projected out over that awful precipice on the right, while the other was on the beginning of the ice slope on the left, which was scarcely less steep than the rocks. On these occasions, Peter would take my hand, and each of us, stretching as far as we could, was thus enabled to get a firm footing 2 paces or rather more from me, whence a spring would probably bring him to the rock on the other side. Then, turning around, he called to me to come, and taking a couple of steps carefully, I was met at the third by his outstretched hand, ready to clasp mine, and in a moment stood by his side. The others followed in much the same fashion. Once my right foot slipped on the right side toward the precipice, but I threw out my left arm in a moment, so that it caught the icy edge under my armpit as I fell, and supported me considerably. At that same instant I cast my eye down the side on which I had slipped, and contrived to plant my right foot on a piece of rock as large as a cricket ball, which chanced to protrude through the ice on the very edge of the precipice. Being thus anchored fore and aft, as it were, I believe I could easily have recovered myself, even if I had been alone, though it must be confessed the situation would have been awful. As it was, however, a jerk from Peter settled the matter very soon, and I was on my legs all right in an instant. The rope is an immense help in places of this kind." Unquote. Now they arrived at the base of a great knob or dome veneered with ice and powdered with snow, the utmost summit, the last bit of solidity between them and the hollow vault of heaven. They set to work with their hatchets and were soon creeping insect-like up its surface, with their heels projecting over the thinnest kind of nothingness, thickened up a little with a few wanderingly shreds of cloud moving in a lazy procession far below. Presently, one man's toehold broke, and he fell. And there he dangled in midair at the end of a rope like a spider, till his friends hauled him into place again. A little bit later, the party stood upon the wee pedestal of the very summit in a driving wind and looked out upon the vast green expanses of Italy and a shoreless ocean of billowy Alps. When I had read thus far, Harris broke into the room in noble excitement and said the ropes and the guides were secured and asked if I was ready. And I said I believe I wouldn't ascend the Altels this time. I said elm climbing was a different thing from what I had supposed it was, and so I judged we had better study its points a little more before we went definitely into it. But I told him to retain the guides and order them to follow us to Zermatt, because I meant to use them there. I said I could feel the spirit of adventure beginning to stir in me, and was sure that the fell fascination of Alp climbing would soon be upon me. I said he could make up his mind to it, and that we would do a deed before a week was older, which would make the hair of the timid curl with fright. This made Harris happy, and filled him with ambitious anticipations. He went at once to tell the guides to follow us to Zermatt, and bring all their paraphernalia with them.